Hello, and welcome to today's Innovative Ideas podcast. My name is Paul Howard. I'm the director and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. Our guest today is Adam Fine, PhD, the founder and president of Pembroke Consulting, a management advisory and business research firm in Philadelphia. Dr. Fine is one of the nation's leading experts on pharmaceutical economics, and he has consulted with 11 out of the nation's 15 largest biopharmaceutical firms. In addition, Dr. Fine consults with clients in the pharmaceutical and healthcare businesses and is the author of hundreds of academic and industry articles, the author and editor of 10 books, and he writes for the popular and influential Drug Channels blog, www.drugchannels.net. Today, we're going to be talking to Adam about the nation's growing shortages of generic drugs, many of them critical medicines for cancer or which are routinely used to treat infections or in anesthesiology. Adam, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
Adam, just to give our listeners a sense of the scale of the shortage right now, we're talking about 168 products as of October 2011. This was from an IMS database of current drug shortages. And out of those products, 82%, 139 of them are what are called sterile injectables, many of them used for cancer, some oral medicines, and then some others that are a little smaller. But even though the absolute number of shortages in the system, 168 products out of, probably thousands and thousands of drugs on the market, both generic and branded. Some of them are critical items, particularly for cancer. So patients may not get their usual dosing regimen, may have to skip it, or it's actually impeding clinical trial research because if you can't test a new drug against the older drug, the trial can't go forward. So obviously some very significant problems here for the healthcare system and then for patients in particular. I think there seems to be consensus about what the problem is, or at least a significant part of the problem, both on the left. Former White House advisor Zeke Emanuel wrote in the New York Times that Medicare Part B's drug pricing program called average sales price was part of the problem. And then the Wall Street Journal editorial board chimed in a couple of weeks ago making the exact same point. But the way I read what you and others have written, it's a little bit of an oversimplification, or at least it's not necessarily the direct effect, but perhaps some of the knock-on effects or indirect effects of this average sale price or ASP. Could you walk us through the problem that the shift from, I guess it was average manufacturer price to average sales price was meant to correct? What happened? And what are some of the unintended consequences we're seeing today?
Sure. And let me just reiterate, the drug shortage problem, I would characterize it at the level of a healthcare crisis, because these are really fairly inexpensive drugs. And that's where we get into the discussion of the drug pricing and how that's affecting the incentive. The average sales price metric was put in Medicare Part B, which primarily deals with reimbursing for office-administered or physician-administered injectable drugs. That's its primary purpose for that part of Part B. And for years, physicians would acquire products from their wholesaler and often receive rebates off of the list price from that product. The payer, in this case Medicare, would base its reimbursement on the list price. And what would happen was the creation of what has often been called a mega spread, where there'd literally be thousands and thousands of dollars of additional profit to the physician because the payer, in this case Medicare, paid based on a list price, yet the physician and the practice was purchasing at a substantial discount from the list price. So one of the ways to do this would be to try to align the reimbursement more closely with the actual cost of the product. And the metric that was used has been called ASP, or average sales price. And to simplify a little bit, is essentially the net revenue per unit that the manufacturer receives for that product. In other words, it's that list price, subtracting out all the rebates and other discounts that the manufacturer might offer, and ends up with their ASP. And marking that up by a relatively small percent, 6%, then became the benchmark for reimbursement. So the intent was to eliminate that large spread and provide, you know, some compensation to the physician and the physician's office for administering these products, but not allow these mega spreads to continue. Now, what happened is, prior to the introduction of the average sales price metric, Medicare Part B spending on these office-administered drugs was growing at a compound annual rate of over 20%. In fact, between 2000 and 2004, spending on those drugs went from $5.1 billion by Medicare to $11 billion just in 4 years. The program was implemented at the beginning of 2005, and almost immediately the growth in spending stopped. And in fact, since then, the average annual growth rate has been 1 to 2% per year. So essentially, by eliminating these profits, it slowed the growth of spending that Medicare was using on these Part B office-administered drugs.
And the interesting thing there is, the way I understand what you just said, so the manufacturer is giving those discounts to the providers in any event. So Medicare is changing its calculation of the payments to the providers. But what did providers do, or what was their reaction to it, that had an impact on these prices to manufacturing firms or the pricing signals to manufacturing firms that affected or generated the shortages we're seeing today?
Well, this is where the story gets fairly complicated. The prices that the ASP data are collecting are actually now reported publicly.
Right.
In addition to collecting them, Medicare put them up on a website, which means everyone can see them now. And because there's a lag with the time with which these prices are collected, collated, and published for use and reimbursement, and the actual market price, and that lag is about 6 months, there can often be a gap or disparity between what the market price is and what the price is on this website. That has tended to constrain price increases because a price increase won't show up in the reimbursement to the provider for 6 months. So it slowed the growth of price increases, so price can no longer react to changes in demand because of this lag and the possibility that during that period of time, the providers would be severely financially underwater. The second thing that's happened is it has dramatically reduced the profitability of actually running a physician practice. Now, in some cases, the administration fees and other professional services fees were increased, but not increased to completely offset the loss of profitability. Now, whether you could argue they were making too much money before or not enough money is hard to tell. What has happened is a large and increasing number of physician practices, particularly smaller ones without a lot of buying power, have started to sell their practices to health systems. In fact, the percent of physician practices owned by health systems has gone from about 25% before the introduction of ASP to almost 60 to 65% today. So there's been a real shift in who actually owns some of these outpatient clinics.
So there's been a massive consolidation of buyers, in effect.
It's been a consolidation of buyers in the sense that it's no longer, I'd say, a cottage industry. It's now one in which the clinics, outpatient centers, are part of larger health systems.
Part of
and they themselves are using their buying power to try to procure these products.
And so these are group purchasing organizations, in other words?
No, I'm actually talking about hospital systems, health systems, who've acquired the physician practices and the essentially, the doctors that said they want to get out of the business of medicine and back into the practice of medicine and become employees of the health systems instead of private business owners running a clinic or outpatient center.
And these hospital systems have in turn put yet more downward pressure on prices for manufacturers.
Right. Well, the hospital systems do themselves get together in group purchasing organizations and negotiate lower prices and discounts. Now, where this has led to the drug shortage gets us to a little bit of a digression in terms of where the beginning of the shortage happened. And the products that you mentioned that are in short supply tend to be generic injectable products, which are somewhat complicated to manufacture, harder to make than a simple pill. And therefore, there are usually very few companies that have even the capabilities to manufacture one of these products. And even if they start manufacturing it, their expected return is fairly low. Now, what has happened is in these markets, if there is a problem, if there's a disruption in supply because of a manufacturing problem or a shortage of a product ingredient, something like that, what happens is it's very difficult for other manufacturers to either increase capacity or to pick up the slack or for new manufacturers to enter to begin making these products. So what's happened is any kind of disruption to the system, to what what I'd call a very fragile supply chain, leads immediately to a shortage of production and a shortage of drugs. At the same time, this price mechanism is very indirect back to the manufacturers. And what's happened, and we've seen some studies showing that the gray market, the market for secondary wholesalers who've acquired these products through whatever means possible, often marks the products up dramatically. Now, in a normally functioning supply and demand situation, that higher price would induce more entry. However, the higher prices are not being absorbed or visible to that manufacturer. Instead, they're being earned by the middlemen, the secondary wholesalers. And the average sales price may not actually change that much. So even though the market is signaling, enter the market, there's a profit opportunity, competitive dynamics would ultimately drive down that profit opportunity. Instead, the ASP system, in part, is sustaining that low price back to the manufacturer, but even though it's flashing red in the marketplace. And that's where we have a real dysfunction, and that's led to some of these criticisms of the ASP system.
So you've got a number of challenges there that converge after you've had this price impact, poor signals to manufacturers in terms of pricing incentives to bring new products, length of time that it may take the FDA to approve a new generic drug application to bring new manufacturing capacity online, or for a firm to even shift manufacturing from one line to another. I assume they have to get FDA approval for that too. So there are just all these lag times built into the system, and then on top of it all, you've got poor pricing signals. Is that fair?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, some of the constraints are physical constraints given the nature of manufacturing a product like this. But some of it is just the difficulty in actually getting the approval to do it, the costs involved in doing that, and then at the end of the day, the expected return can be fairly low. The consolidation that's happened in the healthcare system has driven a lot of prices down, which normally we think of as a very good thing, but unfortunately it's led to a very fragile supply chain and a very narrow supply base.
How can we address this problem? Is there any effect that we could have from shifting Medicare Part B drugs into Part D? Is there some other solution that you've thought of that policymakers should be thinking about?
Well, since the causes of drug shortages are so various and complicated, unfortunately, there's no single solution to any of these problems. In a general sense, one of the most immediate needs, which I think has been belatedly recognized by the FDA, is to, as quickly as possible, figure out a way to allow manufacturers to enter into the market. I think the FDA has begun this process. They have started to do more expedited reviews and have what they would term regulatory flexibility. Yet, it is not something that comes naturally to a bureaucratic organization like the FDA. Their objectives are typically to be more risk-averse, and therefore they are lagging, in some cases, what the market needs. And that's been a message that has been communicated to them, and they are trying to address. But again, that is not in their, it's not in the nature of a large government bureaucracy to move quickly to react to a market signal.
Right. In the medium to long term, is there anything that we should be thinking about, either tax incentives, perhaps tax credits, expanding market exclusivity for some of these critical single-source drugs, or even patent extensions for branded companies to encourage them to stay in the market longer or at least keep their capacity to bring these things online faster available?
I think there are many solutions, but I think one of the things that would be best would be to rethink the use of the ASP benchmark for generic drugs like this. And that would allow the price system to work a little more effectively. For many branded products, that average sales price is an appropriate metric to use to represent what might be the amount you should pay to the provider. But when it comes to some of the generic drugs, we're talking about numbers that are very, very small, very relatively inexpensive products, and adding 6% to them doesn't create a lot of incentives or a lot of financial profit anyways. So by crushing down the profitability so hard on these very, very inexpensive drugs, we've ironically created this system. And I guess I'll contrast it with what's happened in the retail pharmacy market, which of course is dominated more by oral solid pills. In those situations, the way that the market works is the intermediaries, the pharmacies and the PBMs and the wholesalers, have very powerful incentives to purchase generic drugs and locate sources of supply because they earn so much more money from a generic drug. Now, ultimately, although they earn a lot more money from it, the system as a whole saves money.
Right.
So the incentive structure is very powerful and has led us to the point where the generic dispensing rate, the percent of prescriptions dispensed with the generic drug, is 75% and climbing quickly. It's led to the point where when a new generic launches, literally the day it launches at 12:01 a.m., those products are being shipped from a wholesaler or from a warehouse to the pharmacy so that they can capture that profit opportunity. And I would like to see a way to use some of those kind of market-oriented thinking applied to these generic injectables. Allow the prices to rise. Don't try to cap those prices at ASP plus 6% for generic drugs, and allow some of those market signals to flow back to the manufacturers, which would encourage more entry, which would encourage more companies to get into this market, and you wouldn't have persistent shortages of really mission-critical drugs that should be paid for.
And so would that involve just removing the cap and let it going to average sales price again?
Well, again, not to average sales price, but I would say that for generic drugs, essentially it's a matter of balancing what the payer wants to pay and having the payer, whether it's Medicare or many private payers who've adopted ASP, not apply those limits to generic drugs and instead apply some metric based on what the actual acquisition cost of that drug was. So, for example, if the, in other words, not the price that the manufacturer is selling it, but instead the price that the provider or physician is buying it.
Okay.
And that would eliminate the issues of spreads being too high, but also allow the price signal to work, because then the customer who's actually purchasing the product would be able to react. In some cases, they would have to pay more, but that price would then flow back and they would be reimbursed and not concerned that if they did actually pay more, they would end up, you know, losing an enormous amount of money, which would de-incentivize them from actually even participating in the marketplace.
Right. Is there any program that actually operates like that today that you could point to?
You know, at this point, there are a number of experiments out there in the marketplace, in the retail pharmacy market, to try to develop some of these metrics. Ironically, some of the, it happens in the way private insurers, usually through pharmacy benefit managers, will try to establish the price that they reimburse a pharmacy for. They try to base it on that market price in some way, but it's a very imperfect system. A couple of Medicaid programs in Alabama and Oregon are experimenting with average acquisition cost reimbursement.
Right.
In other words, separating the cost of the drug from the cost and value of providing the professional service of pharmacy dispensing and counseling.
Right.
And so you'll see the many state Medicaid programs are, you know, essentially using the laboratory of democracy to experiment with this. And CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has announced its intention to create a national acquisition cost survey, but it's somewhat controversial. It's being opposed by some pharmacy groups, and CMS doesn't have specific congressional authority to conduct this survey. So while the survey is in process, there is a vendor that's been chosen, the status of it is somewhat unknown at this point.
So this shortage, this critical shortage we're seeing now, going to continue for some time. Other market-based solutions are available and could be implemented, but really it's going to take a focus on moving away from the attempt to minimize provider payments and rather maximizing value for the healthcare system as a whole by encouraging more generic substitution where appropriate.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to say it. We've seen in the, you know, not in the retail space, and the outpatient prescriptions, many of the intermediaries be highly incentivized and very successful at driving down healthcare costs and driving generic substitution because they have a financial incentive to do so. So rather than being managed or mandated, we've allowed that system to exist and allowed those entities to profit from lowering everyone else's costs. and that's what's worked. I think that philosophy or framework could be brought in to the Medicare system and into the Part B drug reimbursement system. But to be honest, I'm not sure exactly who or how would champion that idea because I've not really heard it advocated very strongly.
Well, maybe that job's going to be left up to you.
We'll see. I don't know if I want to take that one on.
But on that note, Dr. Fine, thanks very much for your time.
Okay, my pleasure.